So yeah, I'm Nancy Heingartner, Krika's Outreach Coordinator, and I'm delighted today to introduce to you Andrea Lanoux. Andrea and I go back a couple of decades to Jewish Vocational Services in Boston, where we both worked for a couple of years in the early 90s. I guess it's not a couple of decades yet. It just feels like it. Andrea is now the chair of the Slavic Studies Department at Connecticut College. She received her PhD from UCLA in Slavic Languages and Literatures, and has published on Russian and Polish Romanticism, Gender and National Identity, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, the poet Adam Mickiewicz, Russian women writers, and the Polish women's press, among other topics. Andrea teaches Russian language at all levels, as well as courses on Russian literature and culture. One of her current research interests is Russian children's literature, and that's what she'll be addressing in today's talk. Developments in Russian children's literature after 1991, genres, imports, and new Russian plots. Please join me in welcoming Andrea Lanoux.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here today. Can you see me a little bit? We want to make sure. This is really an honor and a true privilege for me here to be talking to you about new research at the beginning of a book project. It isn't every day that you get to talk to people from the best Slavic department in the country. Do you know that that's what people say about you, the best Slavic program in the United States today, about work that hasn't yet been written, and to get input and have a discussion with people on that topic. So truly a valuable opportunity. Thank you. I should say at the outset that most of the work I'll be presenting today is for children ages 0 to 12, which is my piece of a new book that I'm writing with my colleagues, Kelly Harold and Raquel Green. They're both of Grinnell College. I'll briefly outline today the developments in the children's book market since the fall of the Soviet Union and the transformation of this market from a highly controlled, state-run enterprise to a largely, although not entirely, private industry. These developments include the collapse of the book market, the state-run book industry, in the early 1990s, the massive import of translated and foreign literature for children, the bifurcation of the market of children's literature into traditional Russian texts and more expensive Western texts in the 1990s, and the appearance of new genres for children in the past 10 years. And by these I mean, for example, children's detective novels, sex education literature for children, and new board books and interactive materials for children. In my presentation, I will argue today that this new literature promotes agency, a sense of ownership, and everyday democracy by addressing the implied post-Soviet reader as an active decision-making subject rather than as an object of, or addressee of a consistent ideological message. Or to put it a different way, that this new literature embodies a rather complicated and not always clear-cut shift in ideologies from socialist to capitalist in a changing repertoire of genres, literary forms, and plots. So literature before 1991. I will not review here the entire history of Soviet children's literature, for that is not our topic today, but I would like to show you a few books from the period immediately preceding the fall of the Soviet Union, from the 1980s, to give you a sense of the dominant aesthetic and genres, and also for the sake of contrast. Obviously, Soviet children's literature evolved and changed a great deal over time, so it's difficult to generalize about that body of work. However, we can say that a number of genres came to dominate in the Soviet period. Folktales or skazki, nursery rhymes and children's poetry, which Russians usually call detsky stikhi. By now, the Soviet classics, such as Kardny Chukovsky, Agnya Barto, Samuel Marshak, and others, early literacy books or azbuki, children's classics, both by foreign and Russian writers, Pushkin, Tolstoy, Hans Christian Andersen, and very many others, and nonfiction works about nature, the natural and cultural worlds. Russians call this usually poznavatelnaya literatura. In her 2007 collected volume, Russian Children's Literature and Culture, co-edited with Larisa Rudova, Marina Balina notes a change in generic and thematic emphasis in children's fiction between pre-war Soviet Union, when such themes as nature, collectivism, and the value of labor, homelessness and orphan children, and sacrifice for the common good dominated that body of work. And post-war literature, which has been, that is post-World War II literature, which was dominated largely by the school tale, adventure tales, and tales of family life. To give you a sense of those genres, of three of those genres, the folk tale, the children's poem, and the school primer, I'd like to show you a few books from that period. which you can see in every case where I knew the date of publication, the tirage or the print run, and also the cost, I've given you that information. So this is an example of poems, a set of poems from 1985. You see that it has a print run of 1 million copies, that it costs 15 kopecks. And this would be in the genre of Detsky Stihie. We see a similar kalabok, folk tale, the genre of a tirage, a print run of 1 million, 15 kopecks, as well as Ryabka, Posadil Dyat Ryabku from 1988, 30 kopecks, 3 million, a 3 million print run. So this was literature for the masses at its best. These books were everywhere in Russia. You could buy them in pretty much any bookstore that you walked into. I should also mention something about the production quality, which you can't really see, I think, in the slide. These are printed on paper that's almost like newsprint, right? Very, very cheap, cheaply made, but everyone had them, readily available. Mukhitsa Gatukha, a 1983 book. I've included this. You see at the bottom, it's a knizhka raskraska, it's a coloring book. So this is about as interactive as we see for children's literature in the 1980s. And here finally is an example of a school primer, Chitayam Sami. You see the print run is massive. Over 2 million copies of this book. This was for first graders to learn how to read. 20 kopecks, everyone, very, very many people had a copy. But if you look at the date here of publication, 1990, right, this is pretty late for a book that looks like it might be from the 1950s, right? According to its cover, we have the pionieri sitting there with their like znachki, doing their uroki, the ideal Soviet child, still in 1990, they're doing their lessons. So after the fall, right? After the fall of the Soviet Union, the changes in Russian literature have been massive, profound, and transformational in their impact. Recall that the production of children's literature in the Soviet Union was once a highly regulated industry, as well as an ideological priority. A great deal of attention, intellectual work, and a great many resources were put into its production. This centrally controlled industry has since opened up to a vast array of new genres, literary forms, plots, and translated texts from such languages as Dutch, Swedish, German, French, Spanish, Hungarian, Japanese, and of course English. Initially, the new market developed unevenly, with, as I mentioned, expensive Western translations and new interactive books appearing in the mid-1990s alongside the traditional and expensive Russian texts. So for example, what does literature look like after 1991? Well, it looks sort of the same as it did, right, for a time. The 90s, there was a dual market occurring in Russia. This divide in the book market clearly mirrored the economic gap between the new Russian elite and the rest of the Russian population struggling to survive economic collapse. To give some statistics here, and these come from Maizuradze's Knigi Rossii za god do millenniuma, right? Vitrina chitayushi Rossii. In order to give you a sense of the impact of the market over the course of the 1990s, we see that in 1991 there were over 1,400 titles published in Russian children's fiction and poetry. Now, for fiction and poetry, in Russian this is simply called художественная литература. So I'm putting them all. Artistic literature doesn't really work, right, as a translation of that. With a total of over 337 million copies printed, as well as 1,053 titles in school books and textbooks, uchebniki, right? Or uchebnaya literatura, a little bit of a broader definition, with a total print run of over 200 million copies. Moving to 1988, by contrast, the number of titles in children's fiction and poetry had grown, actually, to over 1,700, while the total number of books printed had shrunk to a tenth of its previous size, to over 34 million copies. The number of school books and textbooks, meanwhile, had jumped to a whopping 3,300 titles, with a total print run of 98 million copies. In other words, whereas in 1991, художественная литература dominated the market of children's literature, by 1988, it represented only a third of the books available for children. Furthermore, half of the book, and this is another statistic that you don't have here, half of the books printed for children in 1993 were translations. So the new literature, I'd like to talk a little bit about. I'd actually like to spend the rest of my talk talking about the new literature, which I'm calling the decline and fall of Russian literature for children, or the Russian Renaissance and birth of agency and cultural pluralism, depending on your point of view and depending on where you stare. In the past decade, the stark divide between traditional, inexpensive Russian books and new Western expensive books has subsided somewhat as contemporary Russian culture has adapted to or has internalized the economic and political restructuring of the 1990s. So pretty much all of the books I'll be talking about, all 55 slides to come, are of literature published in the past decade, right? The most exciting stuff has come out in the past 10 years. How one views these changes in the book market for children depends on where you stand. While many Russian critics continue to bemoan the death of quality literature for Russian children, some are beginning to view this cultural explosion of new text genres, heroes, and themes as the foundation of cultural pluralism. I will concentrate the rest of my remarks here on this literature. So let me go back and say a word about Parasyonok, Pyotr, and Mashina. So let's do a little typology of the new kinds of books that came out after 2000. The first would be the board book. Right? I remember when I went to Russia in the 80s and 90s, my friends, I would say, what do you want me to bring? And they would say, bring board books, the hard books, right, with the hard pages that your children don't eat. There were no board books in Russia. So when they start publishing board books, we see one by whom other than Lyudmila Petrushevskaya, the famous writer who actually started as a children's writer, had a number of very famous works come out in the 1990s. One, and I'm not citing it here today, but if anyone's interested in the site, it's a zaumnaya stihotvorenie, very much a sound piece, almost like the 1920s, right? Zaklati smiechom. It's a nonsense poem that makes sense somehow because the words convey through sound, they convey mood and meaning. But here we have Parasyonok, Pyotr I Mashina, a wonderful little board book by Petrushevskaya. So already we can say that there is an original Russian literature coming out in this new form. Then we start to get the interactive books, right? Маленький красный автомобиль, приключения на дороге, and this is книжка с подвижными картинками. So the book that opens, right, with moving parts. Again, the aesthetic is starting to change, but it's not, right, it's not wildly different from what we saw in the pre-Soviet period. And then we have, right, getting closer to moving towards the West, we have the theme of the market start to appear, right? Чудесный магазин, right? Buying and selling actually becomes a theme. Going to the store, right, becomes a theme in post-Soviet literature for children. And as we see, it's волшебное. Going to the store is magical, right? That actually, when you go there, you pull out your little the flap, and you get a colorful item where before it was just a plain old black and white. But I'd like to say a word about the anxiety about this market, right? The new market that has emerged. Let me go back. We don't see the main character of the story of Чудесный магазин, but he is a flamingo, right, who invites his friends, all of his black and white friends, the panda, the zebra, to his store, and he's actually gay. So the flamingo is gay. So and you can sort of pick that up through the language. So there's definitely a corruption of this market, right? That there's something slightly illicit about it or perverse, right? And you see that more that you see that rather often, right, in the treatment of the market. You can buy little soft-sided pillow books now for children in Russia about shopping, за покупками. That are very much about moving your Velcro pieces of цветы in рыба and everything you're buying, right? So it becomes книга игрушка. We start to see книга игрушка as a type. We have books for newborns, right? The книга, the книжка погремушка, the rattle book, right? So here we are marketing books for the first time to newborn children who are actually teething on the book, right? Again, exotic animals, right, in this one, but there's a whole series here. Рисуем и стираем животные, right? This becomes a popular new theme, a whole type, in fact. The pedagogical book that is fun, right? The book where you turn learning how to write your letters into a game, right? Веселые уроки, you'll see that come up again and again. As one of the new types of books. And you'll see it also has stickers, right? We have more than 100 nakliki, nakliik, right, inside. So the sticker book becomes a big interactive book. Paigrayim pashitayim knigas magnitami. You move the magniti around. Patrogi ipaglat, right, the touch and feel books. Knishka kusalka, my favorite. This is the book that bites you, right, when you press down. This is a very popular one. I've seen this in a lot of people's homes, right, that you push down on the little paste, on the jaw here, right. But I also like to draw attention to the tiraj, to the print run of these books. We don't have a million anymore, right. A good print run is 5,000 now. In this new 3,000 to 5,000 is a typical print run for the new literature after 2000. Another kind of book that we see, in fact, this is an old genre, right? The poznavatelna literatura, the literature about nature, culture, nonfiction, we would call it, right? Educational. So here we have Udivitelnye raskrivayushchiye konstruktsiye. This is the book that you open it, and all of the pieces are moving, right? Very, very complicated book inside. Or the human body, we've probably seen this, the 3D with the transparent, the different transparent files. And by the way, and we'll get to this in the end, the human body now in the post-Soviet world has genitals, right? And we'll talk about this as we get to sex education literature, a completely new genre in post-Soviet children's literature. Not only books with stickers, but knishka sabyomnami naklikami. Now we have 3D stickers, right? Everything about these stickers invites interaction and doing, right? Marskiye abitatelye. The lift the flap books in Russia are better than anything I've seen, actually. This entire book here, this knig of padarok about ritsari, every part inside is moving, right? Inviting. It's actually a little castle when you open up the book, right? So again, very much engages the child, even a preliterate child. Could play with this book. All of these, I should point out that most of the books I've just shown you are translations, translated literature. Legendarnye vonje trafarety, so stencils, right? Here's the book with the stencils, right? But the point I wanted to make about all of the rather than just say to you, oh, books are really interactive, I would say that they are hyper-interactive. Like many developments in Russian cultural history in the past, I think all at once, the developments, right, that evolved, there's a kind of telescoping, right, or bringing into Russian culture immediately, and even better, right, even better than elsewhere, a genre, and here it is, the interactive book. Now, I want to move now to the more Russian. Those works look very, very Western to us, right, except for the Cyrillic letters. We've seen that kind of book before. And then here we have Morskoy Tsar и Василиса Премудрая, играем с русскими сказками. So we're going back to the сказки, right? Harking back to our roots, and yet it looks somewhat different, right? Inside there are here 75 stickers, right? So as you read, you are interacting with the tale. Or Большая книга Кощея Бессмертного. Anything you want to know about, right? Кощей Бессмертный is in this book. They've taken pretty much all of folklore, Russian folklore on Кощей Бессмертный, and put it into one place. Mm-hmm. So building on tradition, and yet moving in a new aesthetic direction. Uh-huh. And now we get to the new old aesthetic, right? Of you could call this patriotic literature or nationalistic literature, again depending on where you're standing. But this book, Чего начинается Родина, is actually from 2008. Mm-hmm. We see it cost 410 rubles. This is not a cheap book, right? At all by any stretch. And this is a book when people talk about the private market, and Russian critics love to talk about the market-driven forces, which are forcing all of this makulatura, all of this very not valuable new kind of literature that's trashy. We see that this book in particular is financed by the Russian, by the federal government, right, to promote a sense of Russianness built on, right, the Soviet aesthetic. So, издана при финансовой поддержке Федерального агентства по печати и массовым коммуникациям в рамках Федеральной центральной программы культуры России. So here we have a counter, I would say, to the private market. That would be the Russian government that is trying to promote a certain kind of publication. And we read at the back sort of the description of this book.
think of actually знаменитый песни советских поэтов, right? These are a bunch of names I don't know. I wanted to ask if people know these names. Эмма Тусовского, Твардовского, М. Исаковского, Вея Лебедева, Кумача и многих других. Они посвящают радость дружного труда, силу человеку, да, человека и веру в высокие идеалы, чувство гордости за свое отечество, with a big O, right, и стремление к светлому будущему.
Here we have, right? So here we are going back and celebrating, right? Celebrating our Soviet history. I actually brought a copy of that book, as well as some other books, for you to be able to leaf through them if you're interested afterwards. But not only, right, do we have a kind of marked or propagandistic view of our Soviet past in celebration, we also have for the first time, this very recent book, children are able to read about 20th century Russian history in a way that I have never read in Russian before. I would say in a very very nuanced, very comprehensive way, right? Rather than the great October Revolution, we begin with how many revolutions were there in Russia? Well, it depends on who you ask, right? And it kind of giving the reader choice to make some opinion, to come to some opinion about the very, very complicated Russian past. I brought this book with me as well for you, those of you who are interested to look at. I think it's a pretty remarkable remarkable book. It has also won the President's Award, right? It has won a presidential award in 2010, but also, and you think, presidential award, Putin, and I have to say, he is presented pretty well in this book. But we also have, right.
Is this going to be a text, or is this?
No, exactly. This is meant to be, it's somewhere in between. It is meant to be a textbook, for use for students and teachers, and yet I cannot say, and I do not know if it's officially adopted as the textbook, right? But it's underwritten by UNESCO, right? And not only, it is underwritten as well by the International Center for Educational Systems. So we have some foreign money here, that is supporting this new view, and I think this rounder, the fuller view of Russian history for children. For example, topics treated in this book include the competing narratives of the revolutionary era, which I mentioned, forced collectivization, the Stalinist terror, as well as the Chechen wars, right? The entire history of them. So there's a pretty much a counterbalance, I would say, between the very, very patriotic view, as well as a more open kind of view.
Question for what age group is the encyclopedia intended?
The encyclopedia, I think it is for среднего и высшего образования. And I will actually hand you the book so you can look. But it is for middle school to high school kids, right? And the visuals are astounding. The visuals in this book are absolutely astounding, right? They go all the way from starving children, right? They show you, I mean, I would like to read this book cover to cover. It's a very dense book with amazing archival visuals and materials. Lots of people, it's like a lot of historians worked on this book.
I got the impression I've seen that too, that it's sort of a gift for highbrow children, or highbrow teens.
Right.
It's kind of a coffee table gift book, but a good one.
Right, but exactly. That's what it feels like, too. Although I don't know, and I'll pull it out, if it's more expensive than this guy, right? That's a pretty pricey little book as well, I mean, for what it is. So then, continuing the Russian tradition, I'd like to talk a little bit about original literature. This book is published, you see, it comes out of, is this one out of Kharkov? No, this is Moscow. I actually think I had that wrong. It was originally published in Ukraine, right, by a wonderful little publishing house with a great name, Ababagalamaga. it is a wonderful little tale, I would say building upon the tradition of space. So we recall space is a very important theme, right, the space, the space wars, Sputnik, the great, right, Soviet reach into space, and the symbol that was for Soviet children since the 1960s. Here we have a quite sad little tale about Piosik, who is left behind as all of his other friends go to the moon, and he has to stay back and tend the garden and do what needs to be done, right? So it's a wonderful little tale, building on, I think, that tradition of the Soviet space tale. Code da Vinci, Lyubka, right, Anaconda, probably all of you have heard about the prominence and the popularity of the detective in contemporary Russia. I should also mention here as an aside that many of the developments we see in contemporary fiction for adults, there is a version of that, right, in children's literature. So detective fiction in Russia, one could say that it's the dominant popular genre in post-Soviet literature. Code da Vinci, Ulyubka, Anaconda is very much a spoof, I would say a mock detective in that genre. But I'd like to say a word about Larisa Rudova's reading of the detective novel in Russian literature and why she asks the question in her book, Russian Children's Literature and Culture, why did this genre, why is it resonating so much with post-Soviet audiences, not only for adults, but also for children? And she argues in her article, From Character Building to Criminal Pursuits, Russian Children's Literature in Transition, she cites a number of genres that, in her view, have risen to the top. And this is one of them, the detsky detektiv. Others are fantasy literature. If you try to look it up online, you should look up fantasy. Fantasy, such as Lord of the Rings, are very popular for young boys, especially horror stories, comics, fairy tales, and what she calls playful literature. And I think she means their igravaya literatura, not the high serious, right, but more playful. With regard to the popularity and predominance of the detective novel, she argues that detective fiction treats contemporary life and promotes middle-class values, bridging the gap between serious and popular literature. The detective novel offers a literary window, she argues, into the criminal world in post-Soviet society, normalizing and, in fact, conquering the often frightening and rampant criminality in Russia after 1991. The heroes of the detective, she argues, are usually bright, educated, urban school children from well-to-do, hardworking families. They exhibit and enjoy the status symbols and material wealth and consumer culture, reflecting a new view of work, she claims. Not work as a social practice to advance collective society, but work as a means to simply make money, right? So according to Rudova, it is this journal, it's this genre that is very much reflecting that people want to read about the changes that are happening in society. They want to see them on paper. But we, in children's literature, we've even gone beyond that and are starting to write the mock tale, right, of detective fiction. A new genre, I would say, of the past decade, particularly, is the novel or the work or the children's picture book of tolerance as a theme. And by that I mean multicultural diversity. Tolerance is the theme of this work and many other. And this book we can see, and this is for you, is supported by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the Netherlands, right? It's a translation of a Dutch writer into Russian who is writing about the Snigushonik and Chuzhestranets is the Krysa, how the Krysa is not accepted into the society that he tries to join and ends up leaving. And they end up losing all the gifts that Krysa has to bring. So the person who is writing on this work right now is Raquel Green. If you're interested in the literature of tolerance that is coming up in post-Soviet fiction, Raquel Green writes about the new series Drugoy, Drugia, I Adrugich, which is the brainchild of contemporary writer Lydia Ulitskaya. Ulitskaya was invited to a meeting of the European Cultural Parliament in 2005, which included a group of independent artists from all over Europe. And after which she developed the idea for a series of books for children ages 10 to 12 and their parents. 9 of these books have been released to date, the first 4 of which treat the traditions and cultures of other nations. UNESCO, again, and the Institute of Tolerance of the Library of Foreign Literature underwrote this project, intending that the series serve as a model for contemporary literature, of contemporary children's books that could be incorporated into the official curriculum of the Russian Federation. So this is just one example of that new literature. I can't really talk about Russian children's literature without evoking Russian film. And the huge impact of media and television on the new literature for children. So Smishariki has come to enjoy almost a cult status of children ages 3 to 10. It's wildly popular. It's actually a really smart little cartoon. It very often, I don't know if you use, Karen, if you teach Smishariki in intermediate Russian, it's a great one, right, to use, because it very much cites the classics of Russian cartoons, such as Prostakvashina, Chiburashka, right? You'll see, if you know that body of work, you really enjoy watching Smishariki. But Smishariki has spun off an entire literature, right, based on its characters, and particularly a new kind of textbook, a new kind of reader, such as these are called Bukvarik Smishadik or Slavarik Smishadik, right, that children love. This is, as we know, this is a tried and true marketing ploy here, the franchise, which we've seen so much in the United States, right, Disney, and there are others as well, Lego, in Russia, Lego books, Bratz books, right, unfortunately. Oh, and also Luntik, another very, very popular, I would say the two big Muntiki right now for children are Smishariki as well as Luntik. Luntik, again, is a space, he's a space creature, he's an alien. And that would be for the younger set, three to six. I didn't have a picture, unfortunately, of Luntik to show you. And then, of course, there's the massive amount of translated literature, Garry Potter, and the Russian ripoff of Garry Potter, Tanya Grotter, which many have heard of. There was a lawsuit about Tanya Grotter as a complete ripoff. But if anyone is interested in the problem of translated literature, the scholar who you want to find is Kelly Harold, who has written widely on this topic. Harold claims that the young adult market, that the young adult market of fiction in Russia is actually quite anemic, are her words, compared to the Anglo-American market. In Russia, that if you're a young, a teenager, mostly what you have to read is Verne, Twain, Poe, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, right, the classics. However, she argues that the Russian market is much richer in translations. In the 1990s, in fact, it was much easier to find work as a translator than it was to even find work as a writer. And as I mentioned earlier, Russians are translating from a very wide range of languages, not only from English. So sometimes she'll go to Russia to find good books for her children that are translated from other languages that she actually can't find in English. However, in response to this, to the dearth of literature for children, NLO, Novaya Literaturna Obozrenia, has started a new series of original Russian fiction. Last I checked in, they had 6 to 8 titles out already, and they are working to give a venue to Russian writers who want to publish for young adults. And this is just one. Leonid Yakhnin is one of those writers. Then we have, I'd like to move on to the issue of gender, gender difference in the new literature. Now, officially, when critics, Russian critics, write about Soviet literature, the claim is that it was a very neutral, gender-neutral kind of literature, that Russian-Soviet literature for children was about deti, как таковые. It was not about девочки-мальчики. I don't know that I agree exactly with that statement, but I think, right, it's interesting to see what people see this as a stark contrast, a gendering, right, of the literature market for boys and for girls. This is where you find out, if you're 12, right, how to go fishing, how to wield an axe, how to behave in public, how to brush your teeth, right? From all very, very basic, how to make an omelet, right? So there's a long book. So I actually brought a copy. If anyone's interested, I have this book with me. It is quite fascinating. It's a great read. And then we have для вас, девчонки, как стать красивой маленькая хозяйка. Ты в семье, в школе, кое-что о мальчиках. I think this is. Pardon?
I'm afraid not everyone here speaks Russian. Could you just translate this for?
Oh, how to become beautiful, uh-huh. Right? The young housewife or the young lady of the house, you in the family and at school, a word about boys, okay, is what this means. I think this is my favorite
cover of books that I'm, to be, this cover is impossible in the United States, right? That is, am I wrong? Any book about how to be a girl, I think, in the Western world would have the jouissance, would have some sort of look of enjoyment about that, right? It would be probably a young girl with makeup, smiling, and feeling very comfortable in the princess outfit, enjoying that. And here we have instead a pretty regular little girl, right, for whom this is an ambivalent experience, right? I wonder, I mean, it can't be an accident, right? What is the publisher conveying? Suck it up, right? This is how it is. And so the entire first chapter is on hygiene, how to groom yourself, right? We have a long section on taking care of the house, domestic duties, cooking. The boys learn how to make omelets, but girls make everything else, right? So I'll put these books out on the table at the end so you can look at them. And then, of course, the princess movement, for better or for worse, has made it to Russia, right? How to Become a Princess. These books, there are many of these translated in this series. And then, of course, Barbie, right? Barbie has made it to Russia. Don't get me started. I gave a paper 3 years ago on Barbie, so I have a lot to say about Barbie. But Barbie books made it to Russia in 1997. And at this point, there are hundreds printed in Russia. And many of them have taken on the conceit of Veselye Uroki, the pedagogical book, right? So this is these books are good for you to read, right? They're also reflect sort of the multicultural tolerance in Barbie, right? Razvivayushaya knyiga, right? This is a book, a developmental book. The whole Baby Einstein movement of buy this book because your child will get smarter, that's very much made it into the Mattel world in Russia. Barbie в деревне, right? This is an absolute fantasy. Anyone who has spent time in the Russian countryside, right? She lives in this French-style villa, right? So there's nothing. There is no relation between signifier here and reality. I think what Barbie, it's difficult to say what Barbie has come to signify in the United States, but I think since the 60s, Barbie began as a kind of girl next door. There was something svoy about Barbie, right? Something having to do with one's own culture, right? We can argue about the value of that and the kind of femininity being projected. But Barbie as a cultural symbol in Russia is absolutely toujours, right? It's completely about an othering experience. Girls have Barbies, who can afford them, right? They're expensive, first of all, right? This isn't about you, this is about adopting, sort of taking on some kind of, and then there's a whole anti-Barbie movement, which is really fun in Russia, right? Kill Barbie nights at local bars, right? You've seen this, websites about Barbie's evil, as representing a sign of Western globalization and what we don't want. Barbie, learning how to count with Barbie, right? 1, 2, 3. And I just want to point out that a Russian friend of mine who lives in the United States saw this book lying around my house, which of course is for research purposes, right? And she says to me, oh, this is great, right? What a great thing that you actually learn, that it's very good for kids, they learn how to count. So this sort of marketing tack is working with Russians, right? That they see this as, I think many people look at Barbie as the root of all evil, but she thought this was a very useful book, right, for her daughter. And then we have the teens, right? There's a lot of literature about how to be a girl, right? Girls know better, right? How to make friends. And I think there is a lot of anxiety about it's tough, right? I think to be a woman developing, a girl developing into a woman in Russian society in terms of the choices, the realistic choices available to you out there, and there's a lot of literature, right, for girls to ostensibly help them socialize into this world as a young woman. And then we have a completely new, the first book I've seen on children's sex education literature is published in 2004. Since then, I've seen 20 titles have come out on sex education and literature. Pardon me, sex education literature in Russia. And let me just say that if trying to buy these books in Russia, it's extremely difficult. You go to bookstores and say, "Hey, do you have any of this?" And they say, "Ah, we just got 3 boxes and they're gone." Raskupayut, people are buying them up. Right there was pretty much no, can I say with confidence, no public discourse of sex, and especially sex for children, until extremely recently. Most of these books, you'll see the original title, this is from the Spanish, a translation from the Spanish, translation from the French. There are many, many translated books on this topic. Few, I think I found only one original Russian text for children. But you see they're categorized by age group, right? The Sexual Encyclopedia for Children ages 8 to 11. And I'm going to put up a slide here now. It's in Cyrillic, so for those of you, it didn't occur to me that people in the audience don't read Cyrillic. The language to me, it really struck me when I read this book for 8-year-olds. Что такое педофилия? What is pedophilism? Что такое эксгибиционизм? What is exhibitionism? Что такое изнасилование? What is rape? Now, I don't know about others of you who speak Russian in the audience, but I had never actually seen these words in print, right? That is, there was no language. Notice they're all calques, right? That is, they're all calques from, right, pedophilism, exhibitionism. We brought that, right? That is, it is our words for that. But I think it's a radical gesture. Right? I don't know, I don't even know how to get at how many children are reading these books, but the fact of their existence that an 8-year-old could conceivably read about pedophilism and a very basic explanation of what that is represents a kind of knowledge and I think possible protection for children. There was no discussion of sexual predators in the Soviet Union, although that fact, as we read in Perestroika era fiction, did exist. It was very, very tragic for many young girls, especially, right? If we read Women's Decalogue, for example, right? Just scathing critique of horrible things that were done to young girls and young women who did not have any knowledge, any discussion, right, of sex growing up. Then we have for teenagers. There are a number of books on sex for teenagers. This is probably my favorite translation. This is a book from 1969, actually. an American published in English that was very recently, 2009, translated into Russian. Now, let's look at the original title. Sex and Your Teenager, A Guide for Parents. For those of you who speak Russian, right? Когда ваш подросток сводит вас с ума, пособие для родителей, которые не спешат стать бабушками и дедушками. So the translation of Sex and Your Teenager, I'm going to translate this back into English. When your teenager makes you crazy, a source for parents who are not in a hurry to become grandmothers and grandfathers, right? So there's a kind of sensational title, I would say, right? Very colorful title to sell this book and to sell this kind of information to parents. Семейные тайны любви для подростков, right? This is about family secrets about love for young people. This is the only book I found that's actually written, I believe, by a Russian psychologist on this topic of adolescence and sex. And then this is already bordering not quite on children's literature, arguably, right? But this is a new kind of literature. These books, these parenting books, How to Parent, How to Speak to Your Child, are listed on Ozon. Ozon is the Amazon.com of Russia, as the most popular, as bestsellers, right? People are buying up this literature. And I think the title, right, Samaya Vajnaya Rasiskaya Kniga Mami, the most important, I mean, it's a very loaded title, the most important Russian book of the mother, right? It's a pretty interesting read. I expected a kind of a blank translation of what to expect when you're expecting. However, what we have is a very Russian treatment of signs of the zodiac. If your child is born a Scorpio, what that means for you. How to access your government money for having a child. I don't know how many of you know of the pretty intense and sophisticated pro-natalist campaign going on in Russia right now in response to the population decline in Russia. Women are paid pretty large amounts of money, thousands of dollars for bearing children. This is Putin. This was under Putin's administration. And this book tells you how to access, how to get those funds, among other things. But not only motherhood. I think someone has finally just clicked with people. Why are women not having children in Russia? Every time I turn on talk radio in Russia, I hear about
рожайте женщины, women need to have children. There has been not much of a discussion about fatherhood and why women are not doing this, because there has been no revolution in the home, really. Women go to work, they have children, and they end up doing everything. But we have here, finally, a new beginning trend of fatherhood literature, right? He's telling stories about his children, little antics, and which is completely new. So I'd like to mention, to say a word about the Soviet critical response to this new literature, which I have found to be pretty consistent. I would say remarkably consistent. What I've seen in the Russian literature about this literature is a pretty serious skepticism, I would say, and cynicism of this new literature. Which sees the new market, I would say, as two things. One, as a kind of racket, right? Or rather than the free market, they would see it as very much an unfree market. And two, as a force that actually kills talent and prevents good people from getting through, right? The whole Barbie market. And if I may, I'd like to read this to you, and then I'll paraphrase. Российская детская... And I forgot to mention, the segue into this quote is a couple kinds of literature that I just didn't have a slide for that I haven't mentioned. Massive amounts of reprinted literature of Soviet, I would call them, детские стихи, so Чуковский, Агния Барто, are being published with very beautiful books, very expensive books, very many of them. It looks like half of the books I see in the store right now are the Soviet literature. There are books for learning foreign languages that you see, pretty sizable literature of religious, spiritual literature for children, a completely new genre, and journals for children have continued, right? Мурзилка, which was a big one in the Soviet period, has continued. There's a good handful, I'd say 6 to 12 journals for children, that is periodical publications for children. And this is one of the more mild comments, I would say, about the significance of this new literature. It's from Irina Arzamasova. She and, is it Sofia Nikolaeva, they essentially wrote the book on Russian children's literature. They have a book out, Detskaya Literatura. It's in its sixth edition right now in Russia. It's the basic text for anyone in psychology, human development studies on children's literature, and what that is, sociology. But here's what she has to say. Российской детской периодике приходится выдерживать нелегкую конкурентную борьбу с западными журналами, навязывающими детям модель потребительского общества. In this consumer, I don't even know how to translate this other than sort of a consumer demand society, right? So the point, it falls to Soviet journals for children, pardon me, Russian children's journals to counter, right, to counter this this pull towards consumer society, right? Барби, Микки Мауса, принцессу и других популярных персонажей используют для продажи детских товаров. Эти персонажи теряют собственное значение и превращаются в рекламный образ обманку. Right, so this is pretty... The sentence itself is a pretty anxious sentence. If we were to do a discourse analysis of the sentence, it just runs on and on and on. Here about Barbie, Mickey Mouse, the princess industry, they are used to sell things to children, to market products to children, and they lose these personages, these characters, Barbie, Mickey Mouse, they lose their very own meaning. And I'm wondering, what is their very own meaning, right, that is being lost here? Because they are turned into an image lie, right? Some sort of falsified image of something else. Now, by contrast, отечественные персонажи связаны теснее не с миром торговли, а с миром семьи и школы. Мурзилка, рекламирующий товар, был бы крайне вульгарен. So, Soviet journals, by contrast, right? They are associated not with products in the market, but rather with the world of family and school, right? To even imagine our best journal, Мурзилка, advertising any kind of product would be extremely vulgar, right? So all these words, and pretty much everything I've read by Russian writers, Russian critics, is about the vulgarity,
right, of the market of new children's literature. So the question, I want to end with a few questions. And the first is, what are children actually reading today, right? Are they reading, is this new literature making an impact on young people? So I took the liberty, we have an institutional partnership with St. Petersburg School of Economics. And I wrote to those students who are 20-year-olds, right? They're sociology sophomores, and asked them, what did they read as children? What were their favorite books? And here we go. Rather than read all of this to this audience, you will see what they're reading, right? The Brothers Grimm, Pushkin, Lewis Carroll, right? We're reading the Soviet authors, Kornei Chukovsky, Gheorghe Astyora, right? And then she also grew up on the Disney franchise, right? Aladdin, Rusalochka, Mickey Mouse. She started reading fantasy literature, right? Harry Potter, Priklushenie Alisi, a little bit of Pushkin, right? I don't remember anything beyond that. So here we have a child, right? Here's a 20-year-old who grew up in completely post-Soviet Russia, who is reading pretty much, except for some television. She's growing up on the same thing that her parents read. Same with college professor, a university professor at the same institution, wrote about what she reads to her 6.5-year-old, right? And what we see from her quotation is that she chooses, the mother chooses her favorite works from childhood to read to her daughter, right? And so there's a pretty conservative, children don't always have the agency to choose what they're reading. They get the books that their parents are buying for them. And this kid is growing up on the canon, on the Russian and Soviet canon. She's 6.5 today, Rita, right? Что касается современной литературы для школьников, здесь я даже не могу назвать никаких имен. So what concerns contemporary literature, I can't even name any names for you, right? So, and finally, this is my final. It is. I want to write to my final image. I'd like to leave you with, this is the Yedini Gosudarstvenny Ekzamen. This would be the Russian version of the SATs, right? That every Russian student, every Russian person who wants to go on to university has to pass this exam. And I was just curious to see, is any of this making it into the official canon? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. What Russian students have to pass their exams in are pretty much, I'm going to guess, the canon that you're being taught here, you graduate students at University of Wisconsin. It's Pushkin, Lermontov, Gogol, the classics, right? Going by some basic formalist literary theory, right? Basic discussion of genres. But otherwise, none of this is making it into the, or has of yet made it into the official canon. So my closing questions for this group, and I would like to move this into a discussion now. Well, the first would be, why should we care? The so what question, right? Why do we care what Russian young people are reading? Why do we care what their culture is, right? Everything I've seen about Russian culture, I would say that I've heard on NPR, that I have seen on the internet, that I've seen on TV, right, is about nashi. About the Pushkin, or pardon me, the Putin youth movement, right? That this neo-Putin movement of getting, of tricking college students into promoting his policies. I asked this group of students in Russia what they thought of Nashi, and I'll tell you, half of them didn't know what it was, right? So if we want to talk about what do we know in the West about young people, not much. And I would say what we think we know is probably incorrect in terms of its popular impact on young people today. Second. The impact, now this is actually an honest question. This is a question that I don't know the answer to that I've been thinking about a lot. Is the function, I'm just starting to now look at these works from a visual perspective. I don't have any training, I mean, aside from a little bit of film studies and how to read a film, on reading images, and it strikes me, I need to get to the body of literature by psychologists that will explain to me how young people who are not literate, right, that children who can't read, how meaning is conveyed through images. Because it strikes me, if you look at the stark contrast between the aesthetic, the pretty consistent aesthetic, the folk aesthetic that we had before 1991, that it does something. What does that aesthetic do? It invites you into a tradition, right? Into a tradition that you can only enter with another person, right? The non-interactive book, you have to have someone read it to you, right? So here you are, you're being, you are entering into an oral tradition with certain visual markers, right, that are identified as yours, as your culture. This is our culture. This new literature is extremely confusing, I think, to people in terms of how does it relate to me and us and our culture. So what is the relation between the image and text in this new literature, and how is it different from what we had before? And then finally, my last question, with which I'll close, is as subsequent generations come to accept this new literature as their own, with all of its implications for agency, the reader who does, the acting reader, the reader who chooses, right? How long can a country go on without genuine free elections, with blatant persecution of political opposition, and without freedom of the press? Is this not, in fact, the revolution? Thank you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I sort of, one of the questions I or one of the interests I have, maybe related to your last question, is that I'm actually an anthropologist, so the cultural studies. All that.
Really, really. Mm-hmm.
But so one of the things I'm specifically interested in is domesticity and family life and vandalism and how all these things are interacting. And so the question I have for you is whether you see in this literature a valorization of domesticity. Because that's something that I've done my research on, but a lot of the people I have conversations with in Russia really seem to feel like there's a divide between their home life, which they're often very much invested in, care very much about, and all of this kind of crazy stuff going on outside the house, especially in politics. And a lot of people, I feel, are just not interested in engaging with the political realm. And so, and this is sort of, like I said, like kind of gut feeling that these things are kind of opposed to each other. Is that something you see in the literature, this like a focus on the family, domestic life, and what's happening in the home? You sort of talked about this maybe ambivalence about the market, and I'm going to go out far and limb and say that politics in a like overt way does not appear in children's literature, right? But probably a whole lot on like the human happening there. But sort of, and especially as we're talking about like books about sort of growing up and engendering adolescence, sex education, that sort of thing, you see that happening on the cover of the book for young girls, right? Like,
Right.
How to become a proper mother, that sort of thing. And so, I mean, I don't know how much, I think that's what I got for your second question to ask me, like what's going on with the interaction with the books, but I don't know if that's necessarily something that's...
What's going on with what?
Like being interactive with the books and being an agent in that sort of sense, I don't think that's necessarily going to lead people in a path to democracy. I feel like a lot of people are interested in action in home, for sure, action with their families, their friends, but that in itself isn't necessarily going to be a challenge to the political
regime. Very, very great questions. I want to take them from the back, right? From the last one about everyday democracy and agency. This idea of everyday democracy, when I've taken two groups of students to Russia in the past 2 years, and we've had sort of round tables with them in St. Petersburg, my students and their students, and what they really wanted to talk about was university life. They were very interested in what it was like to be a college student in the United States. Can you change your major once you pick a major? Can you choose to live where you want to live? Can you, and the questions about, you know, that they in Russia they have very much a European track system. Once you claim sociology, and there was a sense in the room that many people would do things differently if they had more freedom of choice, if they could change now that they know more. And one of the young women in the room said, you know, I understand that we don't have democracy here in Russia. She wasn't talking about up here. She said, because I don't have democracy in my daily life. Like, I can't, and I found it a very revealing little sort of light bulb comment that she made. You know, I think students, when they get together, they want to talk about the elections and up here, but this understanding of, I'm understanding that I don't have the kind of choice that I would like to have about my daily decisions that I make in my life. And so, you know, I wasn't actually talking about democracy and voting. I was talking about
how long can, at what point, I mean, are these kids are realizing this, right? That we don't have the kind of choices that other people have and we want them, right? And I am wondering if this kind of literature, maybe it's not, maybe it's a stretch, but treating the reading individual as an agent, as a sexual person, which means as a human being, this is new. To me, it feels like a new gesture. And so I guess that's where I was pointing in that direction. Now let's go back to the question about home, which is very, very wonderful and difficult. Post-Soviet children's literature, okay, there were a few dominant shifts, right, from the pre-sacrificial, pre-war literature. One was the school tale, major genre, not home, but school, okay? It's not the family that's the most important connection in your life. It's your friends and your school buddies, right? And then the second was family literature, right? So under Khrushchev, this became sort of a theme, right? Sort of feminization of culture and a masculinization of this society, and also the dysfunctional family, right, became a kind of topic in Russian children's literature. I haven't actually paid attention to how this comes up as a theme in this literature, and I will now that you've asked me the question. But this kind of thing, right, we see all the time, this socialization of women. There's a big movement on radio and television, and women themselves, without anyone telling them to do this, a sort of a flight to the home, right? After having worked in the workforce for 73 years and at home for 73 years, and that was terrible, let's just work at home, right? Let's just take care of the hearth and let someone else do that hard work of being the worker. So I'll be interested if I were to try to give you an answer, I just have not been thinking about that, but it's a great, is it reflected in this literature? I'm going to guess yes, but I don't know. I can't point you to any works. No? Yes?
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions, and one is just sort of maybe a bit of a clarification.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll start with that. I'm just wondering how you interpret the story of, you know, moving from a few titles and massive print runs to a lot of titles and smaller print runs. Is that
right.
A story of, you know, moving from, I feel like you could read it as like you've got these classics that are just being mass produced and distributed to this other, this newer state where you've got a whole bunch of variety. And
right.
But then when you brought up those quotes at the end that seem to show that, you know, maybe this new literature really isn't getting to the children in any real sense. Is part of the explanation of the small print runs that people just aren't buying it very much? Like it's not getting into the school libraries. It's not.
Right.
And my other question is just sort of a larger understanding of, you know, I've been looking at sort of the post-Soviet media and how that industry transformed and how it sort of weathered the 90s. And, you know, a lot of scholars kind of give a story that, you know, to paraphrase and probably get a lot of details wrong, you know, where it's like a kind of this early innovation and being able to have this freedom to try out different things, but then because of the competitive market forces and the crisis of 98, you know, a lot of people getting, a lot of businesses getting cut out, a lot of conglomeration going on that leads to this, you know, process of elite competition and the ability for state forces to kind of come in. As I, you know, listening to the story you tell about the children's literature industry, it sounds like it weathered the storm a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, you know, what are your insights as to why? Did it weather the storm better
right.
of sort of the 90s and the process of privatization and then why?
Right. Again, two really huge questions. So what do we make of the move from massive print runs of fewer titles to much smaller print runs but much more variety? So first I would say, in one citation that I did not read to you, is the number of books per children that were printed in the Soviet era. Was it 6 to 12 books per children? And that number has now gone to 2. Two books per children, per child. So, per child, pardon me. And so this is all assuming that everybody buys equally the same number of books. And what we see happening is, no, these are probably for middle-class kids. For the new, right, we can have this discussion of, is there a middle class in Russia now, and is that emerging? And I would say yes. And I know some of those people who would identify as the new middle class, and they have all this in their house. Right? So yes, what to me that leads to another question of, what does this do, right, to social reproduction, social reproduction theory, right, of people, you sort of become who you're from, that kind of thing. If there isn't that legacy anymore, no one can become who they were from anymore, because we live in different times, right? Then what this is creating is a kind of class society that is a more has more differentiation from a nomenclatura that is extremely privileged and has access to everything, and then most everybody else. So there's a little more variety there, I would say. That these things aren't in the libraries. I am going to do library research this summer, so I'll answer that question to you. I get the sense that many of these are held in libraries, and that none of these are held, that none of the new literature is recognized as of value by the institution that is the school. The state school, right? So there is a curriculum in Russia, right? Very different from here. It's hard to find anyone who's read the same book at this point, right? There is no functional canon, I think, in school. And I have this problem when you're teaching literature and you want to illustrate an example with, has everybody read, right? And you put it up here, and no. Has everyone read The Great Gatsby? No. That might be the one, right? That most people have read, but. To me, the impenetrability of this state canon is similar, I would say, to what you were talking about of the impenetrability of the television market, which is a monopoly, from my understanding, right? That is a state-sponsored, even though, right, a private with private money, that's a pretty controlled industry, much more so than this. I mean, what happened here, what happened in Poland, in other countries I've studied, is that as soon as the market collapsed in the early 90s, you had other, right, you had big publishing houses from Germany or from the United States, right, very often from Germany, coming in, right, Egmont Limited. They publish all the Barbie stuff, right? And so you had a kind of spontaneous, you had a vacuum. And Western companies who were ready to take that over came in and did that immediately. And probably, so I'm going to guess that the forces that are driving this, if you want to call it diversity, if you want to call it bunch of junk, valueless junk on the market, right, whatever it is you want to call it, are looser in the book market than they would be in television, it seems. No? Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another two suggestions for books that everybody in this country has read.
Tell me.
The Most Dangerous Game, yeah, and The Light in the Forest. I think they hit those in the high schools pretty heavily.
Has everybody read those books? Nope. We can spend the next 15 minutes actually doing that and talking about. I think we'll be hard pressed.
Okay. I did have a question.
Please do. Yeah.
Is it possible, or has any effort been made to evaluate pricing and availability of books, both in pre-Soviet times with today? Can any kind of comparative study or examination be made on that?
No, that's a really great question. Mm-hmm. Because when we see the book is 30 kopecks, and we say, mm-hmm, oh, wow, isn't that cheap? I don't know if it's that cheap when you're making 70 rubles a month. Mm-hmm. Do you see? Right. So it's hard to say. But I do think in the Soviet period, there was very much a culture of having books in the home. Now, this, we're getting here to the heart of the matter, if I may address it to this audience, and this is a question that might be offensive to some people, and I'm going to put it out there anyway. And it's about totalitarianism and cultural values. Now, I see most people in Russia who love literature, who are either in the industry or they work for journals or they're writers themselves, having a real hard time with this new literature, right? They find it completely valueless, vapid, right, insidious, everything that you can imagine. There's nothing, what I read in the criticism, there's nothing for children to read now. And then a long story about how sad that is, that there's nothing for children to read. These are people who grew up in a totalitarian regime, right? Mm-hmm. And one would think, I would think, well, isn't it great that we don't have the state controls anymore, right? That people can publish whatever we want. Is there no recognition here of what we have gained? And, you know, I thought back to my own 20-year-old self when I went to Russia for the first time, and I'm guessing many grad students here have had this experience. When you go to Russia for the first time, and you meet Russians, and you realize their if you can call it a cultural value system, right? What is important to people who live in totalitarian regimes? Nature, art, literature, friendship. You know, it's very striking, I think, for the college student to say, "Wow, right? I mean, this is a culture where things have meaning to people, right?" And I think that sense of what was dear to us, buying books that you, if you are intelligentная семья, you have books in your home, that whole sense of loss of that is what people are talking about, right? Of what's making people very, very worried and very sad.
It's always interesting as a scientist to see how once the communists fall, the quality of paper in the books shoots up.
And they all become 10 times more expensive. Yeah. Sure. So yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I think you made a very good point about new classes being created in the sense that very much in the sense that what we have here. I mean, there are very good studies that show that a 3-year-old who is the son or daughter of a upper middle class family is hearing millions more
words right.
And different words.
Right.
I get the impression, and of course the people I've spoken to in Russia are generally highly educated, articulate, and what they want for their kids, at the same time that they have a sense of the crap that's coming from the West,
mm-hmm.
they want their kids to read what children from the West are reading.
Mm-hmm.
They ask me, you know, to bring books
right.
that are by Western authors,
mm-hmm.
or to tell what our kids here reading so that they can find either translations or something else. And just like we all have, these contradictory messages at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It also reminds me of the criticism, you know, Bakunin had an ABC of communism, where he said, you know, in the West, they said they have a free press, but the capitalists own it. It's the same thing. We have everything now, but it's crap.
Right.
But I think the most important thing is that there is a new class of children who are reading or able to read
mm-hmm.
or have available to them very different sort of stories,
right.
And that is important.
And my guess is now that the families you're talking about, that the quotation I gave you from Irina Shemilyova, who is
right.
a college professor, whose daughter, she reads the classics to her daughter, I think that these families will get both, that these children will get both. They will get a grounding in classical literature, in the Russian tradition, and then they will set their sights on something more. Right? Foreign travel, study abroad, this kind of thing. And this literature, I think, very much, it's not so vredna, it's not so harmful if it's not the only thing you're eating, I think, is the view. Any other? Yes, please.
It seems sort of similar to what's going on here in the United States with television. We've gone from an era in the 50s and 60s stations, and everyone would go home and watch the evening news and then
right.
one of these shows and then go to work the next day and sit around the coffee cooler,
talk about it, yeah.
And talk about what was on I Love Lucy, which sort of engenders a cohesiveness
sure.
in a society if you're really trying to build a sense of nationhood. You've mentioned how these books sort of inculcate the new books that are coming in tolerance, and yet you're having a balkanization, like you said, that's
mm-hmm.
no canon anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So if you view the television of old as our canon in the video,
yeah, interesting,
that,
yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, and we had the same thing with literature, at least when I was going to high school, and sort of Paul and Twain, and polarization in society mm-hmm. where we don't have anything in common with it. You know, now everybody watches a different thing on television and all the stations and that. Mm-hmm. Unless it's the Olympics or football or something, there's you know often not that sort of topic to talk with people about this next day. Isn't that sort of the same process as what's going on in the world?
I think so, and I think there's something to what you're saying, right, about cultural canons and how they function as a language, as a common language with people. And yet, so first of all, we can't say the canon is dead in Russia because they still, if you want to be anybody, if you want to go to any university, if you want to get a job, you have to know it. And I challenge you. I brought a copy of the book, right, of the SAT for literature in Russian, of the graduate students of the program to take that test and see if you can pass it. It's hard. It's hard. That said, so no one is letting go of the canon, right, in Russia. That is in place, period, because the state controls, because states are still very, very university-run, even though they're privatized in some way, right? But what you're making me think of in terms of the decentralization, the kind of when you have so much variety, when you have so many channels, when you have so much of what is happening in Russia, again, the telescoping, when you get all of it at once, they didn't have a gradual development of multinational capitalism in media, right? It sort of all happened at once. And I heard a very interesting paper by David McFadden of UCLA back in November about social networking practices in Russians. Russians apparently social network, so the internet is one of these other things that it all entered Russia at once. They are huge users of social networks, and I mean twice as much as any other developed country, right, that binds them. Why? Because it seems to me, I'm just thinking about why would that be, if there was no civil society really in the Soviet period, there was something else. There was this lie that everyone knew was a lie, and then what really happened of value, what was really true and genuine happened in the home, in the private sphere, and I think this is what you're interested in. Personal contacts, personal connections, in an anthropologist would be very interested in this. How you get done what you need in life. If you need to buy shoes, you know someone who's a butcher who can, right, and then he gives you meat, and then you know the shoe guy who will, right, that everything is done through barter, through people you know. I think social networking is working in Russia to bind people virtually in a way that society functioned not so long ago. So I think there are...